Can we fight climate change without tackling inequality?
The important way in which that issue of economic extremity and inequality connects to the environmental issues is that there's been a lot of research showing that the so-called resilience or sustainability of societies is directly connected to their social solidarity and their equity. So when you have a highly unequal society, it's a society that is not going to be able to weather forms of extreme weather.
That's Ashley Dawson. We talk with him about his groundbreaking book, Extreme Cities: The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. That's on the menu for the hour today on Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rianna. As we know, climate change is ramping up our weather to unprecedented extremes. Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Sandy in New York, and Harvey in Houston. Massive wildfires in West Coast cities. We call them natural disasters, but how natural are they? It's not just that human activity is causing climate change. It's also that our social and economic arrangements are making the impact of climate change much, much worse. They're also keeping us from being able to respond effectively to those impacts. My guest, Ashley Dawson's new book, Extreme Cities, examines the fundamental ground on which climate chaos is playing out in the urban landscape: predatory capitalism and its most glaring feature, extreme inequality. New York City is the main example he explores in the book, but he also travels further afield to places like Louisiana, Indonesia, and the sprawling megacities of the African continent. There he shows how the drive for profits and endless growth are endangering the survival of the majority while creating exclusive, supposedly safe zones for the wealthy minority. Ashley Dawson is an author, activist, and professor of English at the CUNY Graduate Center and at the College of Staten Island, City University of New York. In addition to Extreme Cities, he's the author of several books, including Extinction, A Radical History, and he's co-edited 4 essay collections. He's a longtime member of the Social Text Collective, where he served for many years as editor of Social Text Online. Well, Ashley Dawson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here with you, Francesca.
This book, Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change, you start out the book with your personal experience of going through Hurricane Sandy. I wonder if you could just give us a brief view of what happened to you and also what your psychological reaction to it was.
Yeah, so I live in Jackson Heights in Queens, and as the name of my neighborhood suggests, it's built on elevated land, and it's in the middle of Queens, so we weren't threatened by the storm, and we didn't have power go out or anything like that. But it was a bit of a harrowing experience, because as I write about in the book, the storm winds were so intense that they drove rain into the bricks and mortar of our building, and the water began to penetrate in through the mortar. And so I was woken up repeatedly during the night by this huge blister of water forming in the paint of the wall and then kind of draining down into the room. So that was very harrowing. It was felt like something out of Kafka, you know, with the wall kind of turning into some kind of animal and the huge blister forming and then the kind of weeping of the water into the apartment. But I really got through Sandy very much unscathed. And the next morning, delivery trucks were in the neighborhood. Everyone had power. So I really was very fortunate. But my experience was shaped by things that happened in the rest of the city. So I teach at College of Staten Island. And although the subway system was knocked out, I had to get to Staten Island to make sure — I was chair of the English department at the time — I had to make sure that our courses were running, and we have hundreds of courses. So I had to make sure that students could get to campus, that professors were teaching their courses. And many people in Staten Island were very much impacted by Hurricane Sandy. You know, many people had lost their houses. Some people had lost loved ones. So I saw that impact pretty viscerally when I commuted to Staten Island. And then I had colleagues living downtown in Manhattan who lost power for many, many days. And they had gone through the experience of 9/11 and having a lot of vital services knocked out in 9/11. So they were somewhat prepared for it. But nonetheless, it was really unexpected to have the power go out and for people to be essentially unable to communicate for quite a few days. So what all of that, I think, dramatized to me was the way in which the city is not one unified space, right? I think that often when people talk about the impact of climate change, first of all, people often talk about it as a kind of global phenomenon, rather one that cuts across different spaces, particularly that impacts cities very, very strongly as a result of their highly developed and highly vulnerable infrastructure. And that's one of the kind of core arguments of my book. And that often gets rendered invisible in analysis of climate change and its impacts. But then, in addition, people tend to talk about cities as homogeneous units. And of course, they aren't. My experience of what happened to different neighborhoods in New York really brought that home. And the fact that it was very hard to move from one neighborhood to the next really brought that home. And so you asked about the kind of psychological impact. I mean, it made me realize how incredibly precarious life is in New York City. And again, I was very, very fortunate, but I was hearing about people living in places like the Rockaways, or Red Hook, who lived in public housing complexes and, NYCHA shut off boilers, elevators stopped working, and if people lived above the fifth floor, often they couldn't get access to water. So people were living in really, life-threatening conditions in parts of New York. So yeah, real sense of the precariousness of urban life and the fact that New York, even though it's the richest city in the country, probably on the planet in some ways, is a very unequal place. So it's not only spatially different from neighborhood to neighborhood, but some people have access to the kinds of economic resources that make them more able to weather natural disasters of various kinds. And some people are living in a state of deep precariousness on a day-to-day basis all the time. And then when a natural disaster comes along, that precariousness is just magnified to a really dramatic extreme. So I think those are some of the things that Hurricane Sandy made me really see, even though I think it didn't prompt the kind of sense of a need for a national reevaluation of what we're doing, the way that Hurricane Katrina did, on the sight of people kind of abandoned on rooftops in New Orleans, prompted a sense of national reckoning. I still think that Hurricane Sandy, in its own way, was a kind of wake-up call to people about how cities are unprepared for natural disasters and the way that climate change is changing life.
I think I told you when I spoke with you before this interview that your book is what I see as a kind of political economy of climate change. It really lies in the very title, Extreme Cities. So explain to us, what do you mean by extreme?
With that title, I wanted to get at the conjunction of extreme weather and socioeconomic and also political extremes and extreme stratification. So, I mean, I think all too often extreme weather gets talked about in a way that is very depoliticized and not connected to climate change. During the past hurricane season, for instance, the Weather Channel and some of the other kind of corporate media notoriously talked about hurricanes and other forms of extreme weather without making any connection to anthropogenic climate change. So there's a deep problem there, and a real need to think about how weather extremes are connected to what we're doing to the planet and to the political and economic systems that are animating our behavior. And specifically, if we really get down to brass tacks, I want to talk about capitalism and the way in which capitalism is an economic and political system based on ceaseless expansion on a finite terrestrial base. And so the kinds of contradictions and problems and disasters that result from that. But then the other kind of connection in terms of the idea of extreme is the notion of social and economic stratification. Right. So the Occupy movement drew people's attention to the fact that we are an incredibly unequal society with one percenters, very, very rich people who control the vast lion's share of economic resources and who have corrupted our political system, basically taken it over and bought it out. And of course, since the election of Trump, with all of his sort of minions of the fossil fuel industry, we're even more aware of that than all of us were as a result of Occupy movement, and I was when I was writing my book. But I think the important way in which that issue of economic extremity and inequality connects to the environmental issues is that there's been a lot of research showing that the so-called resilience or sustainability of societies is directly connected to their social solidarity and their equity. So when you have a highly unequal society, it's a society that is not going to be able to weather forms of extreme weather. And so if we're going to really climate-proof our cities and our societies, we have to tackle inequality. We have to tackle the economic dysfunctions that capitalism is promoting in our societies.
Yes. And in fact, you know, it's been called the Anthropocene, anthropogenic climate change. You say actually it would be a better term to call it the Oligopocene.
Yeah, I didn't invent that term. There's a very useful book by two French historians called The Shock of the Anthropocene. But this is something that's been very much in debate in the environmental humanities, and I kind of push back against, of course, the geologists who are debating when the Anthropocene is officially supposed to have started. And the point is that, again, you know, societies in general were not responsible for the forms of climate change that kicked off arguably with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. You know, this was something that was driven by a small number of societies, right, with Britain being the first society to really industrialize, to begin intensive exploitation of fossil fuels and start putting carbon in the atmosphere in significant quantities, of course. But then in addition, it was a capitalist elite who were benefiting from all of that, right? And exploiting the rest of the planet, colonizing the planet, taking people's resources and preventing them from developing. And that dynamic has continued to play out. So when you look at international negotiations, at, for instance, the United Nations climate summits, you see that the countries of the global south who are basically in kind of per capita carbon emissions not at all responsible for climate change, not to mention the sort of long history that I mentioned, nonetheless, they are not getting an adequate say at the table. It's the interests of powerful nations like the U.S. that repeatedly are driving the negotiations, and the fact that we still haven't got a binding agreement to cut emissions, you know, the mitigation piece is still missing, is a reflection of those kinds of inequalities. I mean, not to mention the fact that there really hasn't been adequate commitment to reparations, to climate reparations. You know, there's a green climate fund, but it's really not had the kind of support put into it that it should have. And even what has been asked for, Hillary Clinton sort of famously pulled $800 billion kind of out of nowhere. Even that is not nearly what the nations of the global south need and what we all need, frankly, for a just transition, right? Because we need to make sure that developing nations move towards renewable energy and other forms of sustainability rather than following the pathway of a place like the United States.
Al Gore, I think, can be credited with greatly increasing the public's awareness of climate change, and yet seems to be somewhat blind to these implications. You have a later chapter in the book that's called Climate Apartheid. Talk a little bit how Al Gore, who we could think is maybe the best of our ruling class in terms of climate change, where he falls down in dealing with these equity issues.
Yeah, well, he certainly has to be credited with spreading mass awareness of climate change, which is incredibly important. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, announced that New York City was going to divest pensions from fossil fuels and that we're going to sue the top five big oil companies. A huge step. But in announcing that, Bill de Blasio really, I think in quite heroic terms, came out very forthrightly and said that big fossil fuel companies, big oil and gas and coal, have purposely spent decades confusing the public. And so what Al Gore did was certainly really important. But As you say, in my chapter, Climate Apartheid, I look at some of Gore's writings and analyze the way in which he uses quite militaristic metaphors about the environment, and particularly, like many other environmentalists, he uses an argument about the threat of climate refugees in order to try and catalyze mitigation, you know, catalyze some kind of cuts in carbon emissions in the global north. So the idea is, you know, unless we cut, then there are going to be climate impacts that are going to displace a lot of people in the global south. And that might very well be true. What it does ignore empirically, I think, is that the vast majority of people who are being displaced and who will be displaced by climate change in the global south tend to stay within their own countries. You know, they tend to migrate internally, often going from the countryside to cities, which is obviously one of the things that my book is about. But in addition to that kind of problem of the analysis, the framework is always, how are those people who might be displaced a threat to us, right? And so when you start asking, who is that us? Well, it turns out to be the wealthy countries, and particularly to people with wealth and power in those countries. And so I think there's a way in which inadvertently the discussions of climate refugees and displacement have played into the hands of a right-wing populist along the lines of Donald Trump, or, you know, people like him in the European Union, where neo-fascist movements have been on the rise, and in some cases, like of all places, Germany, have begun to win political power again after decades following the end of Nazism. And it's all around these kinds of arguments of the danger of immigrants and refugees coming to our societies, rather than about what our responsibilities are, how we can have adequate reparations to global South countries to help them have just transitions, and how we have a responsibility to give harbor to people who are displaced. So that kind of anti-racist sense, you know, was not part of the initial framework for a lot of these conversations, and that's really where I fault Al Gore.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ashley Dawson about his book, Extreme Cities. Now, on this point, I was really struck by your discussion of refugees, of climate refugees, because you point out they don't have any civil rights. They don't have any rights of refugees, that there is no kind of international language to recognize climate refugees that would allow them to come into countries as if they were escaping political persecution.
Yeah, I think that that's right. You know, what I argue is that they're legally invisible or juridically invisible. The United Nations Convention on Refugees was forged in the wake of World War II, very much informed by the experience of the Holocaust and, you know, the need to for countries to have some protocol in place that mandates them legally to provide safe harbor to people who are displaced as a result of targeting by political movements for some identity category of theirs, right? So the model of the persecution of Jewish people in Germany and other parts of Europe during World War II is really what informed that convention. And of course, it's hugely valuable and hugely important to defend that. And there's a lot of backsliding on it today. But the problem is that in the case of climate change, threats are much more diffuse and much more complex, right? So, I mean, if we take the example of Syria, which is one of the things that has catalyzed a lot of kind of reactionary movements in the European Union specifically over the last couple of years, you know, Syria, arguably, a lot of the displacement was connected to climate change. Basically, studies have shown that there was a long drought, which meant that farmers weren't able to survive in the countryside. Many of them migrated to Syrian cities and got involved in the uprisings, pushing for democracy, but also just pushing the government in terms of providing adequate sustenance, you know, daily bread or something like that. And then the situation escalated and deteriorated from there when the Syrian government responded to those protests with force and, you know, with killing of many, many people. So that's a kind of example of a complex emergency where there is political violence, where there may be targeting of people for their ethnicity, but where there is also a contributing factor of climate change. And yet that contributing factor is hard to see, often hard to understand, and tends to get rendered invisible. And it very much plays out that way in terms of international legal agreements. So there is no climate refugee status that will allow someone to get harbor in another country. And there have been attempts recently by particularly Pacific Island peoples to take governments in more wealthy societies like Australia and New Zealand to court and push for climate refugee status, and they've been turned down because of this history of the UN Convention on Refugees. So there's a real problem with people being rendered invisible. And I think it's connected to the broader kind of problem of climate change and how we make it visible, how we understand it, and the way that it intersects with many other kinds of complex emergencies today.
And of course, if we're really thinking into the future, we ourselves will become climate refugees.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Yeah, it's not only global south to global north where climate refugees are an issue. And obviously, this is a tricky term. After Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of pushback when some people called the people who were displaced from New Orleans as a result of Katrina refugees. And figures like Al Sharpton said, no, they're not refugees, they're American citizens, as if you couldn't be a refugee within the United States. And I certainly understand that sensitivity. I mean, of course, we know that there are all sorts of ways in which African Americans continue to not be acknowledged as full citizens of our country, whether it's through, you know, electoral hijinks that dispossess them from the right to vote, or you know, police violence, militarized police violence, just to name a couple of examples. So I can understand that sensitivity, but we do need some kind of a term, and we do need an organizing rubric to fight round that acknowledges that there are going to be mass displacements. I mean, just to give one example, the Army Corps of Engineers right now is debating whether or not southern Louisiana should be abandoned and the city of New Orleans should be evacuated, and you know, they should basically cut the river close to Baton Rouge, right? So a football field worth of Louisiana wetlands are being lost every single hour. So things are shifting, and the people who live in the Mississippi Delta, they are going to have to move. So the question is, how do we acknowledge that? And how do we make sure that there is just retreat? In other words, that the wealthy who have the economic resources to pull up stakes and buy land elsewhere, buy a home elsewhere, aren't just doing fine and leaving behind the poor who end up underwater, both literally but also economically, and unable to move, right? So we really need to have these conversations in the U.S. and on a federal level, but also on a state and city level, because we're going to have to shift people within cities, we're going to have to shift people within states, and some states, significant portions of some states, like the bottom third of Florida, are eventually going to have to be abandoned. And I'm not talking, you know, thousands of years from now. I'm talking by the end of the century. You know, I mean, these are decisions that our children are going to be making. And so we should start these conversations now to make sure that they play out in a way that's equitable.
Yeah, and as you point out in this book, these are not, you know, we think of climate change, extreme weather, as natural disasters, but you say they're actually human disasters.
Yeah, so I'm very much building on the work that my friend and colleague Neil Smith articulated, and again, this was after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. He said there's no such thing as a natural disaster, that at every stage of a natural disaster, there's a human calculus, a social calculus that makes the difference between life and death. You know, societies, as we've already been discussing, that are unequal tend to be ones that leave the disadvantaged far more vulnerable when a natural disaster strikes. But then in addition, when rebuilding is happening after the natural disaster, again, those inequalities play out, right? So the way that we tend to frame disaster relief or rebuilding or whatever we tend to call it, whether it's FEMA or some NGO like the Red Cross doing it, tends to be in terms of building it back, right? How do we get our societies back to where they were before? But our societies are ones where there are, you know, really significant portions of the population who are absolutely struggling on a day-to-day basis with high unemployment, insecurity of tenure in their homes, mass poverty, and many, many other factors. So getting people back to the stage of rampant inequality that they were at previously just doesn't make sense. And we know from what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina that what actually happens is not building back to the way things were, but a kind of disaster capitalism where powerful, wealthy interests rush in and take advantage of the shock that natural disaster creates to privatize public infrastructures and make money hand over fist, right? So after Katrina in New Orleans, the school system was privatized and turned into a charter system. Public houses were demolished. And I think that social movements in New York City learned from that and fought very, very hard to make sure that the post-Sandy rebuilding process didn't play out the same way. Things still could be better. There's still many people in New York City who are struggling with mold in their apartments, particularly public housing, where, you know, they don't have access to heat in the winter in a way that's consistent. So we still have a long way to go. But I think there's been a lot of learning about the ways in which disasters are not just purely natural, but are a product of these inequalities, which are social and political.
Yeah, and you, in your book, Ashley Dawson, In Extreme Cities, you talk a lot about the example of New York, not exclusively. There are some very interesting, I mean, you talk about New Orleans and Louisiana, you talk about Jakarta and Indonesia. So it's not just about New York, but New York is very much at the center. And so I'd like to explore now some of those, some of the response that New York did after Hurricane Sandy. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about this notion that cities are the greenest places to live and that New York City is a shining example of that.
Yeah. Well, look, I love New York, and I think that we are incredibly fortunate to have the compact, densely built urban fabric that we have. I mean, just walking around on a street in New York City is an exciting experience because there's so many other people walking around and so many interactions. You know, the sidewalk ballet, as Jane Jacobs called it, is still a really important feature of New York life. And of course, that's made possible by our public transit system, you know, the amazing subway system that we have. Of course, at the moment, it's suffering from breakdowns that are a result of a long history of underfunding. So we have a big struggle on our hands politically to rebuild it and get it functioning adequately. But there is something to that idea that cities like New York are something that leads to very low carbon emissions per capita, right? If you compare a city like New York to a city like Houston, we know that Hurricane Harvey hit Houston particularly hard because with no adequate zoning and without any kind of decent affordable housing programs, the way that people moving to Houston coped was to settle further and further in the exurban fringe, right? So the city just sprawled and built huge highways and essentially mowed down the wetlands that surrounded the city. And of course, those wetlands played an essential role in absorbing strong rains, which is what Hurricane Harvey brought. So if you could find an example of the kind of city we should not be building in the United States, or even more importantly, in the rest of the world, you know, like in China or in India, Houston would be it. And of course, Houston's also the capital of fossil fuels in the United States. So it's not by chance that Houston looks the way it does. It's, again, you know, natural disasters there are a product of political and social and economic history. I think New York is a much better example of the kind of cities we should be building. But having said that, I think it's important not to fetishize compact city form without an analysis, a broader analysis of the political economics of it all, right? So there's been a lot of writing by David Owen and other critics celebrating New York City. But what I think that tends not to acknowledge is that, first of all, there are some McMansions in New York, particularly in Manhattan, that are a product of real estate boondoggles and people trying to sink massive amounts of overaccumulated capital into some kind of physical space. And that kind of wealthy 1% real estate is responsible for the lion's share of carbon emissions. That and, of course, all of the corporate glass towers in Midtown and downtown. So the average person's carbon emissions in New York are actually dragged much higher because of the emissions of the one percenters and the corporate sector. But then also, you know, people who are in the 1% in New York City, while they may have relatively low carbon footprints when they're in New York City, they rarely only live in New York City. They usually have country houses. They usually have a lifestyle that hinges on flying around the country and the world. And so if you only talk about their carbon footprint in the city, you're ignoring the ways in which the city actually is not limited to its physical footprint, the way that their economic and social and political networks that extend out from the city. And you can talk about that on an individual basis. But the clearest example, of course, is Wall Street, right? I mean, you know, New York is the center for finance capital. And what happens in Wall Street determines so much about the way development happens in the rest of the country and the rest of the globe. So if we're going to talk about and celebrate New York and the low carbon emissions that New York has, we also have got to bring, you know, the elephant in the room into discussion, and that's finance capital and its impact globally.
Ashley Dawson. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about his book, Extreme Cities, after the break.
How high is the water, Mama? 2 feet high and rising. How high is the water, Papa? She said it's 2 feet high and rising. But we can make it to the road in a homemade boat, 'cause that's the only thing we got left that'll float. It's already over all the wheat and oats. 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Mama? 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 3 feet high and rising. Well, the hives are gone, I lost my bees. Chickens are sleeping in the willow trees. Cows in water up past her knees. 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Mama? 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 4 feet high and rising.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today talking about the connection between extreme inequality and climate change. Our guest is Ashley Dawson, whose work centers on cultural studies and environmental humanities. His book is Extreme Cities: The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. Just before the break, we were talking about New York City and the role its financial and real estate industries play in the creation of and response to climate change.
So how does real estate development in New York create, for, as you say, forms of irrational and unsustainable urbanization? Not just what you talked about, but I'm thinking more of, say, for example, I mean, look at all the development that happened in Lower Manhattan after Sandy, as a matter of fact, and that's happening right now. I recently took the ferry on the East River, and I saw all those buildings going up in Long Island City, and I'm thinking, this is madness. Why are they building there?
Yeah. So one of the things I try and wrap my head around in the book is Mayor Bloomberg, right? Because he's such an interesting figure. On the one hand, he's been heroic in supporting environmental efforts in the city and globally. And yet, when you start digging, there's a more complicated history there. So the first thing to say is that during his time as mayor, he embraced a lot of plans to green the city, to make it a more environmental city. The most famous, of course, being Plan YC, which was this kind of all-embracing effort to shift the city to a more environmental footing. There were specific components of that, like the Million Trees Initiative or the Bike Lanes Initiative. And those are great, and they should really be celebrated. They're important things that cities should be doing. However, there's also a component of that sort of effort to green the city that I think needs to be questioned, and that's the way in which it's part of a promotional campaign to support brand NYC, you know, to get New York City to compete with other cities in this global capitalist marketplace. So when you have competition between cities to develop and green development is part of it, there are also many other parts of that competition and that development that are happening in tandem with the green parts. And that's what we really need to unpack and be critical of. So what I then end up talking about is the ways in which, as you just said, as part of Bloomberg's tenure, there was a policy of developing former industrialized parts of the city. So he rezoned about a third of the city, I mean, a really huge part of the city, from kind of light industrial to residential, or to some kind of mixed residential and light industrial. And in the book, I talk about this famous moment when many of his proteges took a tugboat up the East River, probably along the same route that you traversed, and saw all these waterfront areas that they saw as abandoned, you know, by industry and ripe for development, and, you know, decided that they were going to change the zoning and develop them. That includes Williamsburg, most famously, but then Long Island City and parts of East Manhattan as well. Red Hook in Brooklyn, you know, the examples. There are just many, many examples, huge swaths of the city. And of course, the latest example is the so-called Far West Side, right? The area west of the Midtown Financial District, which real estate elites in New York City have been trying to develop since the 70s, and now it's finally happening. And all of these areas are in the floodplain. They're all in flood zone A, the areas that should be evacuated. So it makes no sense whatsoever to put housing here. I mean, I argue that they should have been developed as parks that could absorb storm surges, but be public amenities for people when they weren't playing that function. And this is particularly important, I think, because it wasn't that these neighborhoods were abandoned. You know, since they were industrial, they were less prized as places to settle before they were rezoned by affluent people. So it tended to be low-income communities, tended to be communities of color that were living in those communities. And they fought for many decades to clean up those areas. You know, places like Williamsburg are centers for environmental justice struggles, and some of the foremost environmental justice organizations, like El Puente in the case of Williamsburg, come out of this long history of struggle against noxious uses of those areas. So there were people living in these areas. They weren't just some kind of tabula rasa or, you know, frontier abandoned spaces that got represented by the developers. And so when the development happened, it not only didn't make sense in terms of the vulnerability of those areas to flooding, but it also displaced people. And what Bloomberg put in place to cope with that displacement, so-called affordable housing policies, really didn't help people in those neighborhoods, because the criterion for affordable housing, and this kind of gets a little bit technical, but I'll try and get through it in a way that's easy to understand. The criterion for affordable housing was pegged to the average income in New York City. And because we have so many hyper-wealthy people involved in finance and real estate in the city, that wealth drags the average up, right? So if you create affordable housing that is pegged to the area median income, it actually is completely inaccessible for low-income people, you know, people in households earning less than $30,000 a year or something like that. So in communities like Williamsburg and Long Island City, people ended up getting displaced and not really being able to access affordable housing. And that had been part of the quid pro quo for development of these areas. You know, Bloomberg said, we're going to develop these areas, but in exchange, we're going to have affordable housing. And also, we're going to have sort of parks in these areas. If you've been to a place like Long Island City or Williamsburg, you know that the parks, while they're important public amenities, they're tiny. You know, they're like 20 feet deep right on the waterfront. And then right behind them are these huge curtain walls of exclusive condos. So, you know, the public amenities are not what they could have been. They don't serve any kind of real storm surge absorption function. And they really are, the whole area has been developed as a place for the elite to live.
And yet, there is a plan called the Big U, which is supposed to wrap around the east side of Manhattan. Well, from the east side down across the lower Manhattan and then up to the west side, approximately from about 42nd Street on the east side to 42nd Street on the west side. Talk about the Big U. And actually, you know, there are many people who think that there's no way it's going to be built the way it was even envisioned. But you have some problems with the way it was envisioned as well. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So the Big U was designed as part of the Rebuild by Design competition, which in its way was quite pathbreaking. It was funded with seed money from the Rockefeller Foundation and then from HUD, Housing and Urban Development, the federal agency. And the idea was to create a competition in which teams of architects, engineers, and also social scientists would go to communities that had been very adversely affected by Hurricane Sandy and assess their needs, assess how to make them more resilient, you know, in other words, less vulnerable to natural disasters, including storm surges like Hurricane Sandy, and create infrastructure that would ameliorate their situation. So in many ways, it was pathbreaking, right? You know, it was not about the Army Corps of Engineers. This is the way things have worked by and large. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers kind of coming in and saying, right, you know, there was a flood here. We're going to throw up a berm or a seawall or something like that. And, you know, that's the end of it, right? So the Big U was one of the prize-winning competitions, and the people involved in the Big U actually consulted with neighborhood organizations, particularly with Lower East Side Ready, which was a coalition of residents of low-income, predominantly Latinx communities in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and really responded by trying to lay out a plan for creating some form of wall or barrier to stop storm surge that would also be a genuine public amenity. In other words, make the wall wide enough that it could have parks on it, that it could have recreational areas, skate parks and handball courts and all that sort of thing, and would expand the very vital need for recreational areas for communities that don't have access to them in Lower Manhattan. So there are lots of elements of the proposals that are very progressive. The real problem is, though, which you can see if you just look at a map, that the Big U, as the title suggests, is shaped like a U, that it stops at 42nd Street on both ends of, or both sides of Manhattan, and that therefore it doesn't protect areas that are low-lying further north, and not that much further north. So as I already mentioned, the far west side of Manhattan is being developed. It's not clear exactly what will happen if another huge storm surge goes into that area. You know, a lot of the developers are saying that they're putting electrical equipment on higher floors of the condos that they're building. But what's going to happen if that whole area floods and if the subway system in that area floods and you can't take people in and out of the neighborhood? Or, you know, if another electrical substation shorts out the way it happened at 14th Street, throwing all of downtown Manhattan into darkness. So there are lots of questions about infrastructure still that come up. But the kind of more long-term issue, which Klaus Jacobs and other scientists talk about, is that walls can often unwittingly increase danger. And they do it because they make people feel like it's safe behind the wall. But of course, a wall is only so high, and we're putting more and more carbon into the atmosphere. And when you do that, you create melting, particularly in the ice pack in Greenland and Antarctica, right, where glaciers are sliding off land into the ocean, raising ocean levels. And we don't know yet exactly how fast that's happening. I mean, the science is getting better at measuring rates of melt. But the problem is that scientists are also talking about tipping points and about the potential for fast change, exponential rates of change, so that we can't predict the future based on melt rates in the past, right? So basically, whatever projections we have, you know, the UN IPCC talks about 6 feet of sea level rise potentially by 2100. That is just kind of spitballing. We can't be absolutely sure. And some scientists who I talk to, particularly in southern Florida, where people are justifiably very worried about all of this, say, no, it's likely to be much higher. and quite quickly. In other words, it's not going to be some smooth, you know, ride up in terms of levels, but it's going to be kind of punctuated, rapid increases with a period of stability and then more rapid increases. So if you build a wall, and let's say your wall is 16 feet, you know, that's estimated to protect you for against storm surges of up to a certain level. Well, you know, again, that's all based on existing projections, but what if we get more melt and stronger and higher storm surges as a result? Then you've built a whole lot of real estate, moved in a whole lot of people, and have hundreds of billions of dollars and, you know, tens of thousands of people in harm's way, ironically, by strengthening and creating more resilience, supposedly, through building these kinds of fortifications. So, yeah, when you start to look into it, it's questions of equity, but also questions of kind of long-term sustainability that come up around projects like the Big U that make them so problematic.
And famously, capitalism is not very good at long-term thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Capitalism is based on making money on a quarterly basis or maybe even on a yearly basis, but certainly not in terms of a longer time frame. And that was something that I found in conversations, particularly I was struck by talking to people in Southern Florida. I talked to the mayor of South Miami, who said, you know, there's a real problem because baked into a 30-year mortgage, which is fundamental to wealth accumulation and intergenerational transfers of assets in this country, baked into those 30-year mortgages is that you guarantee the person who you're going to sell your property to that it's going to be good for the 30 years. So how can you know that when you're not sure about projections for the future and when the risk of the past is no guarantor for risk of the future? So we're entering a perilous and uncertain future, and a lot of our ways of reckoning or thinking about the future no longer make sense, and that includes things like 30-year mortgages.
So one of the things, Ashley Dawson, that you talk about in this book, Extreme Cities, is about how do we work with climate change? How do we build structures that are actually resilient? You talk a lot about the word resilience. And what does resilience actually mean? So maybe first, just orient us a little bit to the idea of resilience, good and bad. Mm-hmm. And then talk about the example of Holland and how they're dealing with this.
Okay, yeah, resilience is a term. It's a fascinating term, and it's one that's a real buzzword. Everyone wants to be resilient. It's been taken up across so many different areas in contemporary society. It comes from the biological sciences originally, and the reason that it's important is that it's based on a recognition that societies, organisms, whatever entity you might be interested in thinking about, tend not to be in a stable state. And if they are in a relatively stable state, they don't return to that same state when they're disturbed in one way or another, right? So sustainability is based on the idea that if we get some kind of disaster happening, our goal is to shift things back to a relatively inflexible condition that they were in previously. What resilience tries to do is to build flexibility into systems, often through a kind of disconnection into different parts, so that if one part of the system breaks down, the whole system itself will be able to bounce back.
Redundancy, I think, is a lot.
Yeah, thanks, redundancy. And of course, the classic example is the internet, which was built as a kind of network so that it was originally built by the military. And the idea was if one node, for instance, if one city was destroyed by a nuclear weapon, then the whole system itself would automatically route messages around that one destroyed node. So I think that the idea is to try to move our societies towards a more redundant but also more kind of resilient basis. The problem that I have with that term is that it's been taken out of the kind of biological context that it was initiated in, and it's being used across many different areas without any kind of analysis of inequality and the role that it plays in creating vulnerability, as we've been talking about already, right? So what resiliency tends to do, I argue, is to shunt responsibility for surviving either incredibly chaotic disasters like a hurricane or even just kind of daily disasters like poverty tends to shunt that responsibility onto individuals or individual communities. And it tends not to emphasize the role of the state in redistributing income and ameliorating inequality. So it dovetails all too neatly with dominant neoliberal discourses. So that's my criticism of it. Though, in terms of what's happening in Holland, I think that it's a good case study because it shows how, while they are trying to advance ideas that could be called resilient, they also are changing their society with a lot of orientation around the state and what the state can do, right? So I talk about the fact that Holland has this really interesting history where there were local water boards that had responsibility for making sure that parts of the country weren't flooding. So there was a lot of kind of local self-determination about what mechanisms you would build to drain water out of what were called polders, you know, the zones that were enclosed and which they famously used the windmills to pump the water out of. But since one polder was connected to another polder, while there was some autonomy, it was also an interrelated system. And of course, if one of the dikes broke, seawater would come in and affect everybody in the surrounding area. So there was also a very strong sense of interconnection. And in the 20th century, after a particularly devastating storm came in off the North Sea in 1953 and killed nearly 2,000 people, what that led to was a recognition that there had to be really massive large-scale engineering works to protect the Dutch from the threats of the ocean and of natural disasters. And so they engaged in these really massive building projects to create barriers which would stop storm surges coming in, but which could also be opened so that tidal areas behind them could have continuing contact with the ocean and wouldn't just die off. So they were really kind of cutting edge and pioneering in their own way. But they required a very strong state and a lot of funding through the state. So it wasn't just happening as a result of the free market, you know, or of kind of the entrepreneurial zeal of individual corporations, which is the way that a lot of ideas about green cities today tend to get pitched in the United States. So my discussion of Holland in the book is really trying to say it's not going to happen through the free market. You know, in the case of Holland shows that when you have a society that's really threatened by serious natural disasters, it's only through the state mobilizing public support and economic resources that you have a response that's commensurate with the threats. But what's been happening recently that's really interesting is that as a result of climate change, the Dutch have been recognizing that those massive engineering works of the mid to late 20th century are themselves threatened because not only are sea levels rising and storm surges consequently getting higher, but at the same time, there's increasing precipitation falling. And Dutch cities like Amsterdam and Rotterdam have big rivers going through them that come from the center of Europe. And that's kind of key to their economic vibrancy, right? So Rotterdam is the home to the biggest port in all of Europe. And a lot of manufacturing and goods that circulate into Germany and other countries enter through Rotterdam. So it has to keep access to the river so that it can get into the hinterland of Europe. But when it rains a lot, the river swells and potentially you also have a storm surge coming in. So you can't just close the gates down because to do that, you would stop the storm surge coming in off the sea, but then the river would flood the city, right? So they have to really experiment with ways of abating flooding coming off the rivers and the seas at the same time that depart from this model of putting up hard barriers. And so they've been experimenting with what some people call kind of forms of living infrastructure, with living with the water, making room for the river. These are some of the kinds of catchphrases that have been tossed around for some of the projects which have been experimented with. And there's a lot of pioneering work going on there. I mean, a kind of concrete example is a square, which is often called the water square in Rotterdam, which during times when there isn't heavy precipitation can be a play space and recreational area for people. But when it rains hard, it has underground cisterns and it can be flooded so that it can absorb a lot of water that's coming into the city. And that's behind what I was saying earlier about the ways in which places like Williamsburg's waterfront could have been absorption spaces for storm surges in New York City. But then in addition to these kinds of things in the urban fabric on a kind of large scale, the Dutch are also finding ways to incentivize individual homeowners to create living infrastructure like green roofs, like green walls, like gardens that can absorb flooding. And when you add all that together, it really creates a significant flood absorption capacity. So they're experimenting on a lot of different levels and doing a lot of important work. It's important, though, to recognize that what Holland does may not be right for everyone else, right? So, I mean, to give you one concrete example, southern Florida is built on limestone formation. Limestone is like Swiss cheese, basically. It's an incredibly porous rock formation. And so you just can't build seawalls like the Dutch have around Miami, because if you tried to do that, the water would just come straight under them and come up through the ground on the other side of the seawall. So the Dutch have become world famous consultants and go all over the place giving their expertise, and they certainly do have a lot of knowledge about these kinds of things, but it isn't necessarily applicable everywhere. And there has to be a real recognition that there's some places where the challenges just are really huge, and forms of retreat need to be discussed and strategized for. And, you know, we talked about that before, but just the one last thing I'd like to add about retreat is that I think it's particularly hard to talk about in the U.S. because we live in a highly masculinist, militarized, imperial culture, and those kind of military lenses shape a lot of our conversations in everyday life. And to talk about retreat, you know, it inevitably has a kind of military resonance, and we don't like to talk about retreat. You know, these colors don't run. We want to build it back. That was the official name for the New York State post-Sandy recovery operation, right? And so when communities in Staten Island try to get state support to sell properties and move away from imperiled coastlines as communities, they couldn't get the state to support them.
But some of them did.
Yeah. 2 out of 10 communities, I believe, on Staten Island actually got support for what they were asking for. So it was basically the first 2 communities that went to Cuomo in New York State and asked to use state funding to do this. They got buy-in, but after that, the state said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. So, yeah, I think there was a kind of recognition that the state didn't want to support this, and that for whatever reason, that build it back had to be the watchword. And this is a huge issue in different parts of the United States. Our flood insurance policies and the vast majority of people who have those policies live in Florida and Texas really are totally dysfunctional. I mean, after this hurricane season, we're now, you know, the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, is now hundreds of billions of dollars in the hole. And as a policy, it rewards people for returning and rebuilding houses and communities that are repeatedly flooded. And this often ends up going to 1%ers, you know, who have very nice beach houses that keep getting flooded and they keep rebuilding them bigger each time. So there's a real disconnect between our policy and the realities that we're seeing on the ground and that are going to get much worse in coming years.
We've talked about disaster capitalism, but I found one of the most, well, let's just say inspiring chapters of your fascinating book. The book is Extreme Cities, and I'm talking with Ashley Dawson about it, is the chapter on disaster communism. And before listeners get scared of that term, you're really talking about the response of ordinary citizens to disaster, to mutual aid that develops. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. I remember going down to Red Hook as a volunteer one day with my granddaughter and my son, where we went to a church, I believe it was. It was a place where there were huge amounts of different items that had been donated for people who had been flooded out in the community in the Red Hook houses, which are some of the poorest public housing projects in New York City. And it was, I mean, I was just so impressed by the organization I saw there. So talk about disaster communism and how that's a different model, and do it maybe through the lens of what you saw with Occupy Sandy.
Sure. So it's obviously a bit of a polemical term, but as you say, the idea is to challenge the notion that we have, I think, particularly as a result of the way that Hollywood represents natural disasters and the social fallout of those disasters. And that tends to be in a very kind of Hobbesian war of all against all way, right? You know, so you see some kind of disaster. Mad Max is the kind of characteristic example, you know, like a drought or something like that. And you get this kind of battle of people trying to kill one another. And usually one strong white guy survives and becomes a leader and everyone else rallies behind them. And so I wanted to challenge that idea and suggest that actually what happens when societies are afflicted by disasters is that social solidarity wins out. And not in all cases, but in many cases, people band together and support one another through mutual aid. And I think the Occupy Sandy experience really showed that. And so I wanted to talk about how that was possible, what kinds of mechanisms made it happen, and you know, what ways we could learn from Occupy Sandy, its experience for the future. So I want to really validate the efforts of activists. But in the interviews that I did with Occupy Sandy activists, I also found out that their ability to create sort of peer-to-peer mutual aid support networks was incredibly valuable during and immediately after the disaster. But that as time went on and sort of disaster relief efforts began to shift into reconstruction efforts, unless those activists had some connection to longstanding community organizations, social justice or environmental justice organizations, what could all too often happen is that elites, whether it was local elites in a particular neighborhood or elite relief organizations like the Red Cross coming in, could take over and could displace activists on the ground and their efforts at mutual aid. So I basically try and argue that it's really important to sink deep roots and to make sure that one is thinking about the role of the state and ways to put pressure on the state, including, you know, on the local city authorities, to be responsive to communities' needs before, during, and after a disaster, rather than hoping that mutual aid will automatically take place.
And yet I wonder if there is some way that we can preserve this kind of mutual aid, because Occupy Sandy was far more effective than the Red Cross or than the state. I mean, obviously the local government and even not local federal government needs to do a better job. Mm-hmm. But do we really want to lose the kind of empowerment that we have in those, that development of those mutual aid networks that happen after disaster?
No. I think that you're totally right. And I think that the ways in which many of the city's pioneering environmental justice organizations, whether it's We Act in Harlem or UpRose in Sunset Park, just to take two examples, have tried to organize after Hurricane Sandy is to find ways to deepen those kinds of forms of mutual aid. So, for instance, We Act's Climate Action Manual for Northern Manhattan proposes the construction of social hubs, which could serve as sites of refuge during a natural disaster, but which in between moments of natural disaster could be places where people can connect socially, can build their social networks, can educate one another about what to do in an emergency, and also kind of build the forms of survival which are supportive in times of, you know, quotidian emergency that we've been discussing. So yeah, I think there's been a real learning process about the need to deepen those social connections. But again, a lot of this has to do with fighting the escalating forms of inequality, social marginalization, and impoverishment, which our society is exposing vulnerable communities to. So it's a huge political and economic struggle. And, you know, it's one which, you know, given what the Trump administration is doing to many of our communities, which we're losing. You know, we're going to keep fighting, obviously, and there are lots of really amazing initiatives on the ground. But there's also a climate which is particularly hard right now. Hopefully people are rallying and are going to fight back and transform forms of governance and create more democracy and justice on both a local plane during the time that we have this neo-fascist regime in power in the federal government, but then, you know, building once we manage to get rid of Trump and many of his ilk on national and international stages.
Well, that's an inspiring place to end here. Ashley Dawson, your book is Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. This has just been a terrific conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's been my honor.
Ashley Dawson is an author, activist, and professor of English at the CUNY Graduate Center and at the College of Staten Island, City University of New York. His book, Extreme Cities, is out from Verso Press. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the continuation of our interview, where Dawson talks about the Hurricane Sandy relief effort in New York City that was spearheaded by Occupy Sandy.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.